përçka njeta. Pyetja që po e shtrojmë në Kosovë 2.0, me synimin që të kujtojmë, të rebelohemi dhe të riimaginojmë gjithçka përreth nesh. Shumica e diskutimeve në të cilat përfshihemi, sillen rreth ndonjë aspekti të jetës. Cilësia e jetës, mundësitë e jetës, pritshmëritë e jetës, vështirësitë e jetës, pasiguritë e jetës, padrejtësitë e jetës, alternativat e jetës. Mënyra se si flasim për aspektet e ndryshme që përbëjnë jetën, flet për atë se cilat përvoja dhe cilat rrëfime konsiderohen si më me vlerë, por edhe se përpjekjet të kujt shpërfillen, smerën parasysh e përçmohen. Kjo ngrejt çështjen e vlefshmërisë. E një vendi rëndësishëm ku shfaqen diskutimet të tilla është për brenda vetë medias. Jeta, donë se ndoshta jo gjithmonë e përmendur si e tillë, është vazhdimisht në qendër të shqyrtimit gazetaresk. Dhe ata që shkruajnë rrëfimet për të, përfundojnë duke marrë vendimet që mund të ndikojnë në atë që dim, shohim, lexojmë ose kuptojmë për shoqërinë rreth nesh. Verzionet të ndryshme të rrëfimeve për jetën dalin nëpër media. E megjithatë, rallëherë mendjesinë e urgjencës ose të vendosmërisë që këto çështje kërkojnë. Refuzimi i injektimit të plot në realitetet para pandemike mund të bëhet korniza përmes të cilës një riimagjinim i jetës jo vetëm parashikohet, por edhe kërkohet të mengolmë. How's life? The question K 2.0 is posing, with the aim of remembering, rebelling against, and reimagining everything around us.
A story of pain. She's the day transcending night. Interrupted, me and her. And this is a story of pain. She's the thousand winds that blow. She's the diamond glints in snow. She's the sunlight on ripened grain. She's the gentle autumn rain. As I awake with morning's hush, she's the swift upflinging rush of quiet birds in circling flight. She is the day transcending night. Do not stand by her grave and cry. She's not there. She did not die. She did not die. He killed her. Adapted from Mary Elizabeth's Fry, Do Not Stand at My Grave and Weep. Body gone, body altered. In a vain attempt to maintain my body, I went swimming that day, the very day she died. Pointless, I later realized. Pointless is the word to depict my frivolous fight to maintain while she was fighting to survive. To maintain and to survive. To be and not to be. Me being and her not being. I chose to maintain. She never chose to fight to survive. Of all the battles one chooses to fight, I'm sure as hell basic survival is not one. While my body was overcoming the water, soaked in an illusion of freedom, she did not stand a chance. I was staying above the water while a storm came her way. She was deprived of control, paralyzed, she was being pulled under. Eventually, she sank. He, the unendurable weight pulling her down. She, yet another martyr in an uncalled for battle. He had already killed her. I just had no idea, not just yet. Living in a thwarted pursuit of freedom with brief glimpses of happiness, little did I know that the world was crumbling, shattered into pieces that hadn't reached me just yet. The storm had arrived. Breathing in, breathing out. Little did I know that she had been killed and I was alive, and this fact would become the very weight that lured me to the bottom. I had to keep swimming. I had to choose to keep my head above the water. Choice was a luxury to her. I had to keep my head above the water so that perhaps one day choice will come cheaper. My body quivered, powerless. But I was alive, she was not. She was violated, dead, in a box. Mine was in shock. He took her life and shifted mine from miles and miles apart. She was gone in a blink of an eye, in a gunshot, in a second. Here we were. Two bodies in orbit, distorted by the whims of a man. One alive, one dead. Two bodies. One forced to die, one forced to live, questioning her very existence. When one has an out-of-body experience, the patterns of this world come into question. The body I tried to preserve and secure, in a world that is so eager to own it, had shifted, forever. Shifted as not to be held back by patterns anymore. My body will prevail. In a new world shaped by bodies like mine. Bodies like hers. Shaped by bodies that won't be owned for the bodies we lost. A place she never had. A place I need to find. I went home. A safe place she did not have. A safe place she didn't get to at least die in. She was away, far away from both, from home and from not dying. She, like many other women, never got a taste of comfort anywhere. They live, if and when they get to live, displaced. There might be better places to die, but there aren't better places to be killed. She was killed out of place, in an illegal place, from a living body, a hopeful voice. She became a murdered migrant woman in a heartbeat. Tables turned. A hopeless intersection. Once again displaced, eternally and repeatedly executed. In a world that hastily chases the news, and that just as hastily forgets, she was no news. In a world eager for scandal, her death failed to even scandalize. In a world thirsty for tales of blood, hers was unwanted. Not quite enough for the headlines there. Not quite enough for the headlines here. And I had to find a place in me for her to rest peacefully. And a place in the world that did not spare a minute of tranquility for her. A place where she's a body, a voice. She was no news. She became the front page of my life. Its headlines, its definition. It was meant to be. That might have been the case for every other death I have witnessed in my life. We learn to practice life, we even call it an art. But one can never practice death. While we cannot learn the unlearnable, what has never been shown to us, we learn to be prepared. To live our lives knowing that death will be an occasional yet constant encounter. While you can never be well prepared for life, one is even less prepared for death. Yet people do everything humanly possible to ease the pain of permanent loss that comes with death. But she was not meant to die. What happens when someone who has lived inhumanely is killed inhumanely? Those of us left in the killing's wake, is there any way of coming out of it whole? I say yes. Reluctantly so, but yes. But you have to come to terms with the interruption. Because murder is not like death. It disrupts, interrupts. And you have to plug back into life. You're never the same after someone you loved is killed. After someone you knew is killed. An acquaintance. Someone whose name you saw on your phone contacts list, even. Someone who sent you an email, even once. It becomes impossible to speak about life without the conversation slipping to death. The one process you cannot undergo twice. You cannot have a bad death once and plan a better one later. The one irreversible process. I too, foolishly believing I had mastered the art of life, thinking life was an art to begin with, always thought that loss has a pattern. pain, grief, healing, pulling yourself together, living. And I thought death was out there, not here. This is the first shock. Her killing changed all the patterns of death. If death ever seemed linear, yours had an insane amplitude. Waves, curves, restless movement, up and down. Her death alienated me from my own language, my bodily reactions, my habits. I have not faced it on my own terms. She did not die on her own terms. She died on a man's terms. He chose the course of life for her, for me. Language rejects her death. Death and her name cannot be in one sentence, which is why she's anonymous today. She's anonymous because she's not the only one. She's anonymous because there are so many names. She's anonymous because she's so present. She did not die. She was killed. Voices muted, voices shifted. What infuriates me is that she was trying to live better. She was almost there, just as everyone is always trying, almost there, trying as long as one lives. And while she was trying, she was shut down, unplugged, disconnected, muted, muted as if she was a noisy TV in a quiet place. Someone else called the shots, not God. I wish it had been God or something else, a car crash, an incurable disease. And that has to be the worst curse, begging for a different death without the chance for a different life. But I can still choose life, a choice she was deprived of, along with her body, place, and voice. Her body taken, mind altered. Her place lost, mind distorted. Her voice muted, mind to be found again. Pain, pain, pain. Pain in a dance with rage. But first, pain, she was killed. Breathe in, breathe out. Keep on swimming until the storm clears. And if it doesn't, I'll build a new sun. One that warms us all. Breathe in, breathe out. Ground, let pain in. Open that can of worms once and for all. Let it in and let it out. Let pain dance with rage. But don't join the choreography. Be the killjoy when there's no joy. There's nothing to be happy about. Let pain in, don't dance. We won't dance a dance orchestrated by someone else. We will not dance in a distorted world that expects us to dance while exploiting our bodies, forcing us to dance, forcing us out of our bodies, voices, places. We won't dance. We will shut the music down so my voice speaking her name can be heard. So my voice speaking her name disturbs the lightness of those that kill and those that witness in silence. So my voice speaking her name can once and for all disrupt, shift a reality taken for granted. So my voice speaking her name can reach her underground, her body, her place, her voice. So my voice can be heard loudly. So my voice echoes and remains unforgotten, unforgettable.
How's life? The question K2.0 is posing, with the aim of remembering, rebelling against, and reimagining everything around us. Qysh po shkon jeta? Pyetja që po e shtrojmë në Kosovë 2.0, me synimin që të kujtojmë, të rebelohemi dhe të reimaginojmë gjithçka përreth nesh.
Hodza drugačiji život. Trebalo mu je 5 godina i 10 mjeseci da iz Indije stigne u Španiju i vidi brata. Osim od Indije do Turske, ostatak puta G je hodao. Kada je došao do Turske, pješice se zaputio ka sjeveru prema Grčkoj. Trebalo mu je 6 dana. Stigavši u Grčku, u Evropsku uniju, Nadao se da je njegov put gotov i da će biti u mogućnosti da započne život, nađe posao, reguliše status. 2 godine se ništa nije dogodilo. I G je odlučio nastaviti ka Španiji gdje živi njegov brat. Krenuvši iz Grčke, propješačio je Sjevernu Makedoniju i Srbiju, a onda je prešao rijeku i ušao u Bosnu i Hercegovinu. Tamo je zaglavio do polovine juna ove godine. U tom periodu je 21 put pokušao odigrati igru, rizično putovanje u EU preko zelenih granica. Dok je bio na Balkanu, razne policije su ga tjerale nazad, i to uglavnom s one strane, strane Evropske unije. Prepreka na putu bili su mu i zidovi, žice, policijski psi, te je toliko puta premlačivan da je to postalo normalno. Sve vrijeme su mu skraćivana osnovna prava, često i hrana i voda. Napokon, oko polovine juna, G je i posljednji put pokušao odigrati igru. Ako ne uspije, vratit će se u Indiju. Trajala je 18 dana i odvela ga kroz 3 zemlje. I na kraju, na vlastitim nogama, koje kao da su bile gole s obzirom na to da mu se obuća u jednom trenutku raspala, stigao je u Italiju i ubrzo nastavio prema Španiji. Igra je sada gotova za G i on ima priliku da započne novi život, napokon. G je samo jedan od mnogih ljudi koji pješače Balkanom kako bi pronašli mjesto gdje će biti sigurni i dobiti priliku za bolji život. Njihova stopala nose priče o životu u svijetu zatvorenih granica, svijetu u kojem nismo jednaki. To je svijet u kojem neki od nas, samo da bi vidjeli člana porodice koji živi u drugoj zemlji, moraju igrati igru u kojoj su naši životi žetoni kojima se igra neko drugi. Od 2015. godine, kada je postala glavna dionica migracija prema sjevernoj i zapadnoj Europi, obični ljudi prevaljuju balkansku rutu u namjeri da ostvare svoj evropski san. Oni dolaze iz Afganistana, Eritreje, Sirije, Palestine, Nigerije, Konga, Turske, Kine, Libije. Koračaju preko polja, šuma, planina, rijeka, ponekad i po 16 sati dnevno. Njihova stopala postaju otvorene rane. U pojedinim etapama putovanja susreću se sa ljudima koji im pomažu i daju nekada novu obuću, nekada prvu pomoć, a nekada samo osmijeh i nešto hrane. Oni koji pomažu često se osjećaju jednako bespomoćnima koliko i oni koji hodaju, budući da su i jedni i drugi suočeni sa okrutnom politikom zatvorenih granica. Boli često ponavljaju ljudi što hodaju. To se ne odnosi samo na fizičku bol, već i na onu koja će dugo ostati u njima kao podsjetnik na tvrđavu Europu, često jaču od onoga što njihova tijela mogu podnijeti. Njihove živote i slobode kontrolišu privilegovani, oni koji mogu ići gdje god i kada god to žele, koji pješače kada i samo ako im se prohtje. Oni žive u svijetu bez granica, smatrajući da su jedini što imaju pravo na tu vrstu slobode. Traže humanitarne koridore, otvaraju izbjegličke kampove koji su nalik na logore, prikupljaju stare cipele i odjeću te ih donose ljudima lišenim života i osnovnih sloboda. Noga me bole, ali znam da će proći, rekao mi je mladi J kada smo se sastali u Sarajevu, nakon što je u 5. navratu potisnut s granice EU. Probao je ući u EU iz Rumunije ovaj put, ali policija ga je zaustavila i potom mu pokušala polomiti kosti. Pošto je otjeran sa granice, srbijanska policija je nastavila gnusni zadatak odašiljanja poruke koja glasi: migranti i izbjeglice nisu dobrodošli u EU. Je će pokušati ponovo, ovaj put iz BiH u Hrvatsku. Boli, sestro, i umoran sam. Ne treba mi ništa, samo da idem. Samo to, napisao mi je na svom slabom engleskom jeziku. Njihova izranjavana stopala su poput slika nove Europe, one u kojoj živimo danas. Slika košmara koji traje već predugo.
How's life? The question K2.0 is posing, with the aim of remembering, rebelling against, and reimagining everything around us. Qysh po qka njeta? Pyetja që po e shtrojmë në Kosovë 2.0, me synimin që të kujtojmë, të rebelohemi dhe të reimaginojmë gjithçka përreth nesh.
From One Home to Another's by Jack Butcher. My decision to leave Pristina had caught me somewhat by surprise. Forced into a choice between being indefinitely locked down alone in the city that had captured my heart 5 years earlier, and heading for a faraway village from a former and increasingly distant life, it hadn't been my first instinct. I'd had no thoughts of leaving, as Kosovo's first cases of COVID-19 were announced on that Friday the 13th, as I sat with colleagues working late in the office to get the story out. And I still hadn't considered it the next day as we trawled through the swathe of imposing new restrictions brought in overnight that limited almost every area of citizens' lives. But after some frantic and rather emotional phone calls with my family members back in the UK, after they'd got wind of the lockdown and imminent border closure, I found the tug of my roots to be overwhelming during a moment of such global uncertainty. With hours to go until the borders slammed shut, and with airlines rapidly cancelling flights, I desperately threw what I could of my life into a backpack and, in the dead of night, headed to the airport. A few hours later, still in shock, I huddled into a plane seat on the last flight out of Kosovo and watched the bright lights of my adopted home disappear beneath me, unsure when I'd be able to return. And so, here I was, amongst the rolling foothills of a remote and rugged national park, in the quaint English hamlet that I'd grown up in, but that I hadn't called home for over a decade. The familiar sounds of talavar or hip-hop leaking unabashed from the built-up traffic was replaced by the occasional hum of a neighbour's lawnmower somewhere down the valley. The rhythm of the call to prayer in the old part of the city replaced by the chatter of songbirds seeking food for their young. I spent much of that spring in denial, telling few people of my knee-jerk decision to desert. The less people who knew, the easier it was to will myself back into my abandoned home. So, as if to assuage my guilt at having left at the first sign of crisis, I threw myself into every aspect of lockdown life back in Pristina, from closely scrutinising the latest pandemic-related restrictions, to hosting online parties for my friends. Part of that also meant diving even deeper than ever into my work as an editor at Kosovo 2.0. Now, as my colleagues and I scrabbled to make sense of what the overnight upheaval meant for workers, single mothers, and individuals already struggling with their mental health, we also found ourselves covering a simultaneous political crisis. With citizens trapped in their apartments and impotent to act, shady dealings by local actors, coupled with the last flings of desperation from the Trump administration in the US, unceremoniously brought down Kosovo's newly elected government of hope. The anger, incredulity, and deep sense of injustice I shared with my friends and colleagues in Kosovo was hard to reconcile with the sedate and tranquil world I was physically inhabiting. In my room, in video calls, I talked of government collapse and constitutional coups, while outside my window, primrose bulbs or the closure of the local cafe were discussed over freshly baked brownies. There may have been the occasional chatter about PM Boris Johnson's health, or another dodgy emergency contract issued to a mate of a minister. And the ever-present post-Brexit fallout inevitably hovered somewhere beneath the surface. But for the most part, I blanked out this noise, considering it small fry compared to the far more pressing issues back home in Kosovo. I insisted that my friends in Pristina take me out, via their phones, onto their balconies each evening to join the nightly protests, as citizens bashed pots, pans, or anything they could get their hands on to register their opposition to the underhand wrestling of power. Meanwhile, once a week, I would step outside onto the front drive alongside all the neighbours to politely clap for the UK's beleaguered health workers, as the number of cases, deaths, and hospitalisations continued to rise at an alarming rate. In those moments of prescribed national solidarity, it was hard not to resent the people around me, lining the sides of a street made up largely of detached houses and bungalows, all nicely spaced by over-attended gardens. We may have all been facing the same pandemic, But what did they know about the existential fears facing those close to me, but now indefinitely cut off on the other side of the continent? The pandemic may have introduced uncertainty into these neighbours' lives, but what was a little uncertainty amongst such apparent luxury? My rejection of my surroundings extended to the beauty of the unassuming natural environment all around me. How could a place that cared so little about the rest of the world deserve to be so breathtakingly perfect, with its ancient meandering lanes, abundance of spring flowers and lush greenery as far as the eye can see? How could a place bursting with perennial life be so detached from those who truly valued what it meant to be alive? Unwilling to accept the cushy local conformity, and unable to do nothing in the face of injustice, I resorted to a late night action to try and shake things up. I'd done my best to preserve my energy in the early months of the pandemic in the UK by holding my tongue as the Conservative government badly mismanaged its response, by first ignoring the threat, then playing it down, before finally bumbling into a series of chaotic and often disastrous actions. But after a particularly galling example of cronyism, hypocrisy and dishonesty, I made my own poster with challenging statements about truth, trust and democracy, and crept out after dark to anonymously pin up copies around the village. And yet, over time, as I passed my poster slowly fading in the phone box window on my daily walk, I came to feel a sense of unease about it. Not that my feelings behind the issues it protested had changed, they hadn't. But in a small and tight-knit community such as this, where issues of truth and trust were lived experiences that bonded people together from all walks of life, I questioned whether this was really the right way to use my voice. I had learned through my job, following protests, talks, and discussions, that principled defiance has its place. But as I gradually came to engage with a surprisingly diverse range of neighbours around me, I remembered that dialogue and compassion are equally important in effecting change. Without these, we become trapped within our own bubbles and fail to see the vast majority are doing what they can in their own way. I'd been adamant when I first arrived back that the village of my childhood had nothing left to teach me. Yet, in its own unique way, each home leaves its mark.
How's life? The question K2.0 is posing, with the aim of remembering, rebelling against, and reimagining everything around us. Qysh po shkon jeta? Pyetja që po e shtrojmë në Kosovë 2.0, me synimin që të kujtojmë, të rebelohemi dhe të reimaginojmë gjithçka përreth nesh.
What I learned from teaching girls how to fight. I can tell you exactly why many people don't want women playing sports, because it is a fuel rod for her rage. A rage of joy, anger, and power. We are mocked for this in almost every other aspect of our lives. But in sport, she gets to feel stronger, more capable, more clever. She gets to fight and feel the joy of winning and the shit of losing. She gets to be herself. And the male world doesn't matter. Her body is suddenly hers alone. It is not there for others' judgment, gaze, or control, but only for herself and her own happiness. We separate boys from girls at some point in sport, not because the girls aren't good enough or not strong enough, but because natural physical differences create a need for categories. People like to claim this categorical difference makes a difference in quality. But this is only so they can keep women and girls out of sport and control our bodies. Everything can change when a boy looks at a girl he has been playing alongside for years and says, "I'm bigger and stronger than you." Or when the boys foul her, or they won't pass the ball to her, they are making sure that she knows she isn't supposed to be there. And we ask ourselves, who raises boys like this to be abusive and police women's bodies and freedom? Even when they are barely in their teens, all of us do, one way or the other. The thing is, and this is something a lot of people don't get, there is not much difference between the bodies of young boys and girls. And while strength and speed are important, so are skills, smart, and technique. Sports is 90% in your mind. So So when we sit there, assuming that male bodies are better than female bodies, that's on us. I thought the young generation would no longer have to deal with this, and that girls would no longer have to battle boys. But a while ago, I saw it happen again. I've been teaching kids rugby for a few years now. As is normal everywhere in the rugby world, I teach girls and boys together until tackling starts. It's only when we hit each other that we separate. Segregating the children before tackling begins would be for me an admission of the failure to teach the value of equality. It would mean I fail to make sure that all of the kids come up together as equals and that girls know they have a place in sport too. I worried about the girls leaving sports during their adolescence. Girls come under pressure during these years, pressure to be considered attractive, available, or proper. These pressures can lead young women to suddenly drop sport because the girl who every boy wants to fuck isn't fighting on the pitch. So the pressure is on, especially in Kosovo, where for all of its prowess and pride in sport, little is invested in the grassroots where all those champions begin, and even less in girls. Knowing all this, I thought I was ready to teach my girls to rage against this and channel it into their sport to demand equality with the boys. But in the end, I failed. I gave the girls my pep talk and told them to hold their space and be strong and that they are the best. I told the boys that their abusiveness was shameful and lectured them on sportsmanship. But in the end, I separated the boys from the girls so the girls no longer had to hear how they weren't good enough, when more often than not, they were better. How can we talk about progress when young girls are still being told the same thing I was once told? We can't say we have progressed anywhere because our progress is temporal and limited. Only some women get to fret about the glass ceiling. But even that privilege can just as easily be rolled back. Put aside the online activism, the advanced academic discourse, or Women's Day marches, women are still in the same place we have always been. We fool ourselves, but we don't fool the world.
How's life? The question K 2.0 is posing, with the aim of remembering, rebelling against, and reimagining everything around us.